Good afternoon. So last time we talked about things related to sort of reliability in our file systems. We first talked about the issue of consistency when we had crashes. And one solution we had to this was careful ordering, that we'd avoid writing data where we couldn't figure out what the data actually was. The biggest issue was we could write a pointer to bad data, so we can avoid that by writing the data before you write a pointer to it, then we don't have a pointer to something which isn't correct yet. And we learned that if we did that, we can fix other consistency problems by scanning the file system for like unused stuff or inconsistent numbers to like deal with most of our other issues. Then we had sort of a better scheme where we instead make it so we churned our manipulations of our file system, like creating a file, into an operation which either happened or didn't using a redo log, where to do the operations, we'd write them to a log and then write that, yes, we are committed to doing this. And if we were committed to doing it, we would, on reboot, make sure we read that log and do those operations again. To handle the case where, what if we didn't actually do them before we shut down? And we would only remove things from this log when we know that the list of operations was actually done. Then we talked about sort of a second type of reliability issue, which is dealing with data loss when like our hardware fails or when someone makes a mistake. So for hardware failing, our solution was we would store extra copies of the data. And the simplest scheme was mirroring, that rather than using one disk, use two. Store two copies. You can read from either copy, so that's even faster. But that solves the problem, what if one of the disks breaks? Well, you have another. And we talked about an extension of this very briefly, of erasure coding, that there's, rather than storing an extra copy of everything, we can store some extra data that through some math allows recovery if we get k of n pieces of our data. So we have, you know, k pieces is the data that we actually want to store. We actually store n, which is bigger than that. And the idea is that with a clever mathematical scheme, we can make it so that if we lose any n minus k of the pieces, we still can recover the original data by just choosing carefully what extra stuff we store. Then we talked about sort of a file system level thing for solution for a less onerous cause of data loss, but a far more common one, which is that some user accidentally deletes or overwrites a file. And a solution for that is we can have file systems that maintain multiple versions of themselves. This idea of snapshots, that we have an array of different versions, these different snapshots. And since most of the versions would have the same data for most files, we'd only store one copy of that data, and the different versions would just each have pointers to the same data. And when we modified one version, we'd make a copy of the parts that were changed, rather than modifying the original, so the older snapshot was still around. So if someone comes to our system administrator and says, I accidentally, you know, overwrote my homework, can you get it back for me? They can say, well, we have a copy here because we didn't actually delete it yet. And we mentioned, as part of making this practical, we want to be able to modify smaller pieces of data and only copy a smaller piece. And one particularly problematic part was the inode array, that if we're thinking about an inode-based file system, we want to not change inode numbers, but we also don't want to like make an extra whole copy of the inode array for each snapshot. So a solution to this is just extra indirection. So now you only modify, you have pointers to each piece of the inode array, and you only modify the piece that changes and change that pointer. Some questions before, and I'll have the picture of that, which is that we would have an array of snapshots here. I didn't quite get to this. And each of them would point to, indirectly, to pieces of the array of inodes. And when we were updating a version of an inode, we just take that piece of the inode array and make a copy of it, and a different pointer for that piece of the copy. Any questions about things we covered last time? Which I'll go back to here. So, redo login and these redundancy ideas. Okay. So, let's then move on to some other little things we have to clean up on file systems. So one thing is, we sort of talked about how files were arranged on file systems, but we're kind of just talking about, we have one disk, or maybe mirror disks, but there's just one storage device where we store everything, but that's often not what we do. Like, I plug in a USB drive, I expect to see a different thing from a different storage device. So how does that show up? So the Unix solution to this is that we have a root file system, which appears as slash, and we make other file systems just appear as a normal directory in there. We do what's known as mounting them to a directory. And they appear as normal directories, and they even, like, we can do cd dot dot and so on. We can go to the parent and the child, as if it's all in one real file system, but the operating system figures out, oh, we are actually in slash net zf15. That's a different file system that goes to a different storage device and has a different policy for how inodes work and so on. So to implement this, the operating system is going to maintain a table of where are all the different file systems we're using, and what type are they, what device do they use, and so on. So, for example, this is from a department machine. We can see that we have the root file system at slash is extended 4, and it uses this device file, dev sda1, SD source SCSI disk. And we have a file system called proc, which is a weird special thing. We have a slash run is a temporary file system with no backing device. So it's just stored in memory. This is just tempfs is a file system implementation that doesn't use a device that Linux has. We can see we have another local disk that uses size dev SDA3, which is another extended 4 disk. We have these ZF2, which is type NFS. NFS stands for network file system. So this is actually not stored locally, but it's stored on another machine. And we have in here the information that the other machine has this address, and so on. So you can see we support Linux supports a variety of different types of file systems here and lets us have multiple of them mounted. And that means that for operating systems like Linux, there's some internal abstraction that multiple file systems implement. So we have an implementation for our network file system that talks to another machine rather than using a disk. We have our extended 4 implementation that talks to the disk driver and deals with inodes and so on. And we have this tempfs version, which just stores data structures in memory. They all implement a common interface. And this, in Linux, is known as the virtual file system API. So they just have an object-oriented API, which is kind of based on the fast file system. So you have an object for the super block or the header, for each inode, for each directory entry, for each file that's open that you want to track, and so on. So this is what you implement as a file system. Note that there's some things that are in, say, for example, our FAT reading project that file systems don't implement. Big example is directory traversal. So there's common code, which knows how to use these directory entries and so on to do the directory traversal. So you don't implement that if you're writing a file system. You just implement the code which says, here are the contents of this directory. And Linux has common code that figures that out for you. And similarly, you don't implement the code which allocates file descriptors. You just implement the code which says, open this file, give me a data structure that represents the file, and so on. Okay. So questions about mounts and virtual file system APIs? Okay. So that's basically what I have to say about file systems in this class. So our next topic, we're going to talk about distributed systems. So what is a distributed systems? Well, it's multiple machines working together to perform a single task. That's going to be our definition. It's not really a very precise concept. So there's going to be different ways we can organize multiple machines to work together to perform a single task. And there's sort of two extremes that we usually see, we can usually classify things into. So one is this idea of a client-server model, so that we have multiple machines working together, but we have one or a small number of machines designated as servers that clients talk to. And the server handles all the coordination, so on. And we have this other model, this which I've labeled as peer-to-peer, where it's just a free-for-all. Everyone can talk to anyone. And everyone sort of has a roughly equal role in the system, whereas the server clearly has a special role compared to the clients. And the client-server model in particular, the idea is that the server is something which takes requests from clients and returns responses to those requests. So the server, doesn't proactively contact a client. The client, isn't even always available most of the time. So example of a distributed system in this sense is like the web. Like your web browser is a client. It's not always on. It contacts the server to get the information it needs to know to do what it wants to do. And this means the client needs to be able to contact the server, but the server doesn't need to have any special information about how to contact the clients in advance, because the server is going to get that when the client contacts it. And the server is going to be always available and just responds to these client requests. So this is the client-server model. And this is by far the most common way people organize their distributed systems, even though there are other options. You could imagine, instead we'd have that both parties just send things to each other unsolicited when interesting information is available. Now, the picture I showed you of the client-server model here kind of suggests that, we're going to just have one client and one server, or, well, more than one client, but one server. But even though the client-server model is common in practice, we usually have sort of an iterated version of it, where we have multiple copies of the client-server pattern in repetition, where we have our web client, which talks to a web server, but the web server is the client for the application server, and the application server is a client, in this case, for an ad server and a database server, and that's how the website works, is that we have, it's a distributed system spread across a whole bunch of machines, and some of those machines are sort of both clients and servers, but there's, but we can say for like a specific relationship, they're just a client for the application server. For the web server is only a client to the application server, and so on. Even though it's a server for the web client, the web browser. And this often ends up being quite complicated indeed. To give a concrete example, this is a block diagram of how Wikipedia is served. To zoom in here, so you get your request which goes to this load balancer, which talks to this thing which handles encryption, which talks to a caching box, which talks to an application server, which talks to a bunch of databases, and also a cache as clients to the client to this server, cache server, and a client to this database server, and a client to another database server. And we have this sort of recursive relationship, which ends up getting quite complicated when you have a big website like Wikipedia, where there's a lot of things you want to support, and a lot of extra stuff you want to add to make things fast in the common case. So the other model I mentioned was peer-to-peer. And the key thing where I say something is peer-to-peer is that there's no single always-on server everyone knows about, and any machine can potentially contact other machines. And often, the set of machines might change over time, and that should be OK. That there's not like a single designated machine that's responsible for everything. It's that it's spread out among the systems. So, saw this model here. So, the question you might have is, why is Wikipedia doing this? Why doesn't Wikipedia just buy a nice big machine and put everything in one program, just settle that way? Why does Wikipedia bother with all these complicated extra pieces? What's the advantage of that here? And there's a whole bunch of reasons to do this. And it's a good question to ask whether you really want to do it, because we made things more complicated. So there must, what's the benefit from that? So one common reason we'll have a distributed system is that they're different machine owners. These could be like legally different owners or just sort of conceptually, organizationally different owners, like different parts of a company want to manage the different machines, and they don't want to have to coordinate on every single decision. So that's one reason we'll have a distributed system, is that we'll have different people who independently maintain their systems collaborating to perform one task. Another reason might be that we want to delegate a task to someone else. So this is the cloud, right? You will, for example, people commonly use a cloud storage service, that I'm going to pay someone else to deal with storing and backing up my data. That means I'm going to make my system into a distributed system where they're going to run part of it because I'm delegating the job of storing my data well to them. But there are also reasons you might do this, even in the case where you don't have separate entities which you want to manage things separately, like in those first two. So one reason is that Wikipedia is like a pretty big website with a lot of traffic. And we could probably build a single machine that can serve Wikipedia, but that would be extremely expensive. And we'd instead like to take a bunch of smaller, cheaper, not custom giant machines and use that to serve Wikipedia. And that's what they've done. So like most of their servers are not like exceptionally beefy machines. They're just something relatively cheap and easy to replace. And since they're relatively cheap and easy to replace, and they have many of them, it's also easier to incrementally add to. If they say, I don't have enough of those, let's say, of these application servers, well, they can just create, add more copies of that server and add capacity that way, which would be a lot harder if this were one application running on one machine. And another big reason is redundancy, that if you set this up carefully, I talked about having multiple copies of a server, you could make it so that any one of those servers could fail and your system still works. And certainly if we're using lots of cheap machines, that's a very good idea, because if I have 10,000 cheap machines, the chances that one of them is broken is probably 100%. So, talked about high-level organization of distributed systems. Some questions on this idea and why we want to make something distributed. So, since we talked about now we want to have things distributed, let's get into, like, what does it mean for these machines to work together? So we have to have some way where we imagine the machines communicating. And I'm going to have a simple, very abstract model of how networks work, because this is not a networking class. We're not going to talk about signals on Ethernet cables or radio waves. We're going to have a really abstract view of networks. And our view is that we're going to start with this mailbox model, that each machine is connected to a network. And if you say, tell the network, hey, I want to go to machine B, it knows how to contact machine B. So I can send something on the network, say, send it to machine B, and it will know how to get there. And we need some way of making use of this in programs. So we're going to have a queue of messages that we're waiting to send. And we're going to send them to the network as the network is ready to receive them. And we're going to have a queue of messages where we're sending them that were not yet received by the program. And we'll consider this queue, you can think of as kind of like a mailbox, that when we send a message, we give it an address to send it to, and it gets deposited in this mailbox here, and the program can later pick it up. And over the network, we can actually, the network just says who it's addressed to. That's all it looks at. It doesn't look at the contents. It just sends it straight through, uninterpreted for us to deal with at the end. So this is sort of a high-level view of the functionality pretty much any network provides. Networks often provide some extra stuff. This is the basics that you expect any type of network to give you. Now, this is enough to implement things, but there's some particular functionality we're going to want to figure out some pattern to implement. I'm going to talk specifically about the client-server model, because that is basically almost always what people use. And in that model, I told you the client sends a request to the server. Well, it seems like we have a way to do that. This hello can be a request for the server to do something. But the server wants to reply to the clients. So we need some way of doing that. So how can we make that happen? What do we need to do to make that possible? What is missing from this picture for us to reply? Yeah. Yes. So we need a return address. And like in this case, you might say, well, it's always A, but we know in general servers have many clients. And the idea is that the set of clients can change over time. So our solution here is we can add our return address. Hello from A. So we receive hello A. So now we have a way of replying. So there's another thing that's kind of missing here, and that's that we might want to send or receive multiple messages. So one example is that, well, it turns out that the amount of stuff we can send per message is limited. So you might just need to split something up among multiple messages that are separate just because it's too big. Another example is maybe we're having sort of a longer request where it's like, hey, I'd like to look in this directory, tell me what's in the directory, and I'll tell you what file I want. So we have some sort of conversation we want to have. So for that, we're going to need some way of knowing that that a series of messages are part of the same operation. that like it's just divided up into pieces. So we're going to have our return addresses, and we're going to track related messages. So we're going to just mark that they're related to each other, you know, or keep track that we know if we receive two messages, they're both part of the same thing. And this is a very useful idea. So we're going to have an abstraction which handles both of these problems known as a connection. So our connection is a two-way channel for messages, and we're going to have two new operations. So as you saw send and receive, we're also going to have connect and accept. So our connect operation is what our client's going to do, telling the server, hey, I would like to, saying that, hey, I would like to connect to this server. So we'll, in that, we'll send something over the network that the program won't see directly, saying, hey, server, A wants to connect to you. And we'll have an accept operation to start that connection. And then when we send things in the future, we'll know they're part of that connection. And we'll have this API where once we get this connection from our connect and accept operation, we can send and receive using that, and these are all tied together. So we can have this sort of conversation between the client and the server, you know, where we like ask the server what's 2 plus 2, and we get 4, and we know that these are tied together in a way that makes sense. And we could ask more things of the server, and it would be all part of this same single connection. Okay, so questions? So if we compare connections to some things we've seen, connections basically have the same sort of functionality as far as communicating between programs as a bidirectional pipe. So if we had pipes in both directions, connections are providing exactly that functionality. And in POSIX, they have the same API. The connections just look like a pipe which works in both directions. So you get a file descriptor that represents the connection, and you can use read and write. So, and this is going to be sockets. We'll talk about that a bit later. So connections are actually implemented over something like the mailbox abstraction. And there's actually a few other things that they need to deal with. One thing is that things can get reordered. Just like in the real mail, if you send two letters at the same time, or like a letter in a package, they might go different routes just by accident, or one might get lost for a little bit. They might not arrive at the same time or arrive in the same order. So that's one thing real connection implementations need to deal with. They need to make sure things stay in the same order afterwards. But they're implemented on top of that mailbox idea. If you want to know how, just take networking. And I think I removed this. Okay. The summary. So how do we do this? I guess we'll talk about that later. Now, talked about the connection idea, but there's a few important missing pieces as far as using connections that we're missing. Like I told you about this sort of connect and accept operation, but I just like said machine A, machine B. But we have to actually hear out what does that actually mean in our real computers? How do we actually say what machine am I talking about? And I've also been kind of assuming that each machine is running one program. And we know that's not true. We know that you can run a web browser and like a chat client on the same machine, and that works. Yeah. Or you can run two different web browsers and have them talk to the same website, and that works. So we need some way of handling there being multiple programs on a machine that deals with that. So we're going to have to figure out how do we identify machines and how do we identify different programs on machines. And for this, we're going to use names and addresses. So names are things that you actually show to people. that you want them to interpret. And addresses are things which tell you how to find something, or the actual location of something, but they're not a logical identifier that you expect people to be able to interpret, that you expect to be stable, but they're useful because they tell you how to get there. And we're going to distinguish between these two. And we've kind of seen these concepts. So like a name, like if I have a variable counter in my C code, the name is counter. But we know it has a memory address, you know, some memory address, like that. And that's what the processor actually needs to know how to access the variable. And we're going to have a similar concept with naming machines. So we're going to give each machine what we'll call a host name. And that host name will be how we'll identify that. But when we're actually working with the network, we're going to have something which is more directly useful to the network to actually address the mailbox of that machine. And that's going to be an address. And we'll talk about the format of these addresses probably in a bit. Well, we can see we have these addresses. So we have these IPv4 addresses. This is 4 bytes here. This is the first, second, third, and fourth byte. They're just 4 bytes separated by dots. And we have IPv6 addresses, which happen to be 16 bytes, written out in hexadecimal with some parts missing. And this concept appears all over the place. We also have it with files. So files have a name, but as you know, when you're, so for example, for implementing the fat read homework, when you're actually accessing the file, you care more about its location. So in an inode-based file system, this would be the inode number to look up that those block pointers and what disk it's on. In FAT, it would be like the cluster number and other information from the directory entry, perhaps. Now, there's another type of name and address we're going to have, which is going to be, we're going to have service names like HTTPS, you might remember for web stuff. And we're going to have an address that corresponds to it known as a port number. And this is how we're going to distinguish between multiple programs on a machine. Okay. So we have these names. You might say, how do these names work? Do we just have a giant table of all the names on our machine? Well, that was the original scheme. The original scheme is that we just gave everyone on the internet a copy of the list of all host names. But that doesn't work anymore. So instead, we have something called the domain name system, which maps logical names to addresses. And this is a distributed system itself. So it's multiple machines working together to do this mapping. And it's distributed partly because it has to deal with lots of different requests, but also because this is a case where we have different people working together who maintain these machines. Different people are responsible for different subsets of these names, and they all want to work together to have one common database. And this is a client-server-based system. So the way this works is I get the address of my internet service provider's DNS server, which is sent to me when I get connected to the network. And when I want to figure out where is cs.virginia.edu, I ask my ISP's DNS server, and maybe my ISP DNS server would know that, but if it doesn't, it's going to ask a common root DNS server. So this is run by some central authority, and that root DNS server, well, it's not going to know directly, but it's going to say, okay, I don't know the answer, but why don't you ask the people who are responsible for .edu? This is their address. And then it's going to use that address to contact the edu's DNS server. And they're going to say, I don't know the answer, but why don't you ask the virginia.edu people? And they're going to say, I don't know the answer, but why don't you ask the cs.virginia.edu people? And that will finally get the answer. Now, an advantage of this scheme is you might say, this seems just like horribly indirect, so we're going to make it faster. So one way we're going to make it faster is, well, the EDU server doesn't change very much. So my ISP's DNS server can cache that and just check every once in a while if it changed. And to facilitate this, DNS has timeouts. Just says, why don't you ask the EDU people anytime in the next 7 days or something like that. And so that's how this is efficient. And it can also cache like the final answer, which is why we want multiple people using a common DNS server. Why that would be efficient. Okay. So questions? This works. So here's our first real distributed system solving this database across multiple people running it. Okay, so now we have our mapping from names to addresses. I mentioned that we have IPv4 addresses. We have those are 32-bit numbers. They're just written out, typically, byte by byte. And the way that IPv4 addresses are allocated to organizations is in these big blocks. So for example, UVA has all addresses which start with the byte 128 and 148. It's all assigned to UVA, and UVA gets to decide how it's going to use all those addresses. And for example, Google has this range of addresses, and this range of addresses, and this range of addresses, and it gets to decide what it does with all of those ranges. And there's a reason why we're going to assign these big ranges of the addresses all together, and that's because we have to use these to locate particular machines, and we're going to have multiple steps we have to go through. And we're going to have some machine that's connected to a whole bunch of networks and needs to figure out, I have an address, I know what mailbox it needs to go to, which network do I send it to? And the way it will do this is we'll have what we'll know as a routing table, where we'll just have a list of ranges and what network they go to. And because we've assigned these big ranges all at once, hopefully this table will not be too big. And I believe in practice, if you are what is known as a tier one ISP, typical size of this table is something like 150,000 entries for the internet. And once we have this table, it's pretty easy to see what does this router do when it gets one of those messages coming in. It just looks at the address on it. It's not A or B, it's this number, and figures out which of these ranges does it fall into and sends it on. Okay, so questions? Yeah, and I guess something worth noting, since we're talking about IPv4, IPv addresses, is that there's a whole bunch of special IP addresses which are private. So we have a huge range of addresses called reserved for localhost. They mean the machine you're on. They don't use the network. They're just a special case. You might ask, why did we reserve 2^24 of these? This is a decision that was made in the 70s that might be regretted now. We have addresses which are private. So these are addresses you'll commonly see that are not used on the internet. But they're commonly used within a network, and then when things go to the internet, something does what's known as network address translation and converts it to a different address going out and converts it from that different address to the original address going in. And the main reason for this is that people can't get as many IP addresses as they'd like. And also there's this special range here of link local addresses, which are not supposed to be forwarded by routers. The idea is I want to use an address for things that I'm directly connected to without having to get it assigned to me globally. Like UVA has that whole block of addresses assigned to it. So that's an arrange for that purpose. Some questions on address? So I mentioned network address translation. Now, very briefly, now I showed you IPv6 addresses. So IPv6 is basically like IPv4, where they said, 32 bits, not really enough. And they wanted to not have to do this again. So they expanded all the way to 128. And it's actually kind of supported. And it's written out in hex. The double colons just represent a bunch of zeros, so you don't have to write out. So you can write this instead of all that. And typically, it's given to users in large blocks, where the idea is now you don't need to do network address translation, because you'll get a lot of addresses. So if you have a lot of devices, you don't need to worry about using only one real internet address. You'll get enough. And I say here, blocks of 2 to the 80 or 2 to the 64 addresses, I'm not kidding. Like, you shouldn't run out, is the idea. And that's why they used 128 bits. And like IPv4, there are special IPv6 addresses you might occasionally see. Localhost, we just have one address now. It's just all zeros and a one, and anything starting with FE80 is a link local address. So that's something which is only for things that you're directly connected to. Routers are not supposed to forward things using that address. Okay. So gave addresses for machines, but we also needed to deal with our multiple programs on machines, and our solution is going to be this idea of port numbers. That we're going to just assign each program a number. And the internet has chosen to use 16-bit port numbers. And you can kind of think of this like multiple PO boxes at an address. That the operating system, it's going to get something for the whole machine, and it's going to figure out which port number is which application and route it appropriately once it gets there. So this is the convention. And the port number space is divided up, and the lower part of it, we have these particular numbers which are assigned to particular services. So we have a port that's used for SSH, for example. So when you SSH to a machine, you don't typically specify a port number. That's because we know that port 22 is where the SSH server is going to be. There's also a range which is allocated on demand, and this is most notably used for clients. When a client connects to a server, we need to give it a port number so the server has a return address. So we'll just allocate a port number on demand from this range of high addresses. And as long as you're not running more than a couple tens of thousands of clients, shouldn't be a problem to find. Some questions? Okay, so I talked about how we're going to identify machines for connections. We have another problem, which is if we make connections, what do we do? And this gives the idea of a protocol. And a protocol, an agreement on how we're going to communicate. This includes the syntax of messages. So am I writing things out in ASCII or something else? It also means the semantics. And protocols are just a thing that humans do naturally. We have some sort of implicit agreement, but with servers and clients, we're going to probably want to make it more explicit. So what do I mean by we have an implicit agreement? Well, we think of a telephone. If I use a telephone, I pick it up, check for service, dial, wait for ringing, and then the person answering it, we have this convention. That person's going to say hello, and I'm going to say hello, this is so-and-so, and we just have this convention about how we're going to communicate. And clients and servers are going to need the same kind of thing. We're going to need to say, does the server say hello, or does the client say hello? You know, how does this work? We just need to have some decision that we make about how we interpret those messages and who we expect to send what. And that's going to be our protocol. And there are a lot of protocols. So one thing we need protocols for is, how do connections work? So I showed you in my sort of earlier examples, like here, I showed you this idea that when we do this connect operation, we're going to send a message to machine B saying we're starting a connection. So we need some protocol which says, how are all the details of that going to work? Who sends what messages? Do I wait for a response from the server to say it's okay, or do I just start? What's the format, and so on? So there are a whole bunch of sort of standard protocols that build these abstractions. So we have the protocol for when I'm talking to a router, how do I tell it who the mail, who the, those things I'm sending to mailboxes are addressed to? And that's the internet protocol. I have protocols for sending, making connections, the most common of which is the transport control protocol, which is built on top of that. And I might build another protocol on top of that. For example, HTTP is a way for protocol for sending files that's built on top of TCP, which is built on top of IP, and so on. And we have just a whole bunch of protocols that you probably have used with this layering. Okay. So, talked about how networks work. Now let's talk about APIs for these connections. So I alluded that we're going to have something which looks like a bidirectional pipe, and the exact name for this thing in POSIX is a socket. And you can think of it as the abstraction for that queue of mail, that mailbox's queue, and it's a file descriptor. And it's going to act exactly like a bidirectional pipe. So once I've set up a socket between a client and a server, the client can write something. And if the server reads from its file descriptor, it will get that data, and it can write something back, and the client will read it. So our code, which actually uses it, so here's, it's rather dense, but let's, here we have a client where we get some input, we write it to the server, and then we read back the response and output it and print it out to standard out. And our server reads from the client and writes back what it gets. So this is called echo because the server just echoes back what it reads. But this shows you sort of the principle, you know, that the client writes something, the server reads it, and the server writes something, the client reads it. We want to implement other functionality. We just put something interesting in the message and have the server, like, not just send it back, but do something with it. So we need to know, well, if this is the API, how do I get one of these sockets? And I told you all about, well, we have a way of naming servers now and addresses for servers, and we have a way of identifying which program on a server with this port number. So I'm going to need to somehow give that to my system in order for it to work. And I have to do the equivalent in order for my client to connect, and on the server, I have to somehow say, I want to run the server with this port number. And this is all going to be done with sockets. I'm going to have some particular operations. So on the server side, we're going to start with a special kind of socket known as a server socket. So to create this socket, we're going to call the socket call, which returns a file descriptor. And then I'm going to say, I want to listen for connections with the listen call. And after I do that, it turns it into a server socket. And this is going to be unlike our other sockets, because we're not going to read and write on the socket. It's not going to be allowed. If I try to read or write after I call listen, it's just going to return an error. Instead, I'm going to use this operation called accept, which is going to create a normal socket. And the reason I'd want to do that is because I'm going to have multiple clients connecting to me, and I want a separate socket for each one, So I call accept over and over again each time I get a new client. From the client's point of view, the client creates a socket, and rather than calling listen, they call connect. And they call connect with information about the server socket I set up. And after that connect call finishes, now they have a socket which communicates with the one the server just accepted. Now they're paired together. If I write to one, I'll read from the other, and so on. Okay. So this is how we set up connections. And the connections are going to be on the network identified by what's called a five tuple. We're going to have the protocol, which is TCP. That is what we're going to use to implement these connections. We're going to have a local address and port number and a remote address and port number. And the operating system is going to maintain a table of all the local address and remote address and port numbers to file descriptor and use this to make sure read and write work correctly. So when you call read, it's going to make sure, well, rather when it receives some data, it's going to look at the return address and the sending address on it. So the return address on it and the destination address, and it's going to assign it to the right file descriptor. When you call write, it's going to look up what the addresses of the file addresses and ports of the file descriptor are and send it on the network with the right information. And part of making this work is both ends will also always have an address and a port. So one question is, where does the port number come from? So there's a function to set that called bind. So you call that on a socket, it sets the port number and the address for the socket. And for servers, you want to do this because otherwise, how is the client going to know how to contact you? But this operation is optional. If you don't do it, we still need a port number and an address for your connection to work, but the OS will just make one, will choose one for you if you don't set one. And for a client, that's exactly what you want to happen. You don't care what the port number is, anyone will work. You don't care what the address is, anyone will work. But for the server, you probably care. And I said we have this table. In fact, you can look up the table. So there's a command to do that. So here's on my desktop, just dumping that table. I have local address, port number, remote address, port number for each connection. And in the operating system, there's also next to this information about what file descriptor does this correspond to. So this gives us sort of our basic way of making clients and servers. So in our client, we're going to create our client socket with the socket call. We're going to call connect to make it go to a particular server. On the server side, we're going to create our socket with the socket call. We're going to call bind on that file descriptor to make sure we have a well-known thing our client can connect to. And then we're going to listen, and we're going to get a new connection, a new socket for each client with accept, and we're just going to run this loop where we read a request from the client, reply to it, read another request from the client, reply to it, until we decide we're done. Okay. So we have our create. And setting up our connection, we have our paired FDs, and then this loop where we communicate. Okay. So questions on this overall flow for our client and server? Okay. So just to illustrate, let's show what the actual socket and connect calls look like. So the way I would recommend doing this, if you need to do this on a POSIX system, is you can get this address info struct that I'll show you how you get that on the next slide. And that will have the information that you need to pass to socket and connect. So to socket, we need to say, what type of socket is this? Is it IPv4 or IPv6 or something else? And what protocol does it use? Is it TCP? Is it something else? So we pass all that information, and when we create our file descriptor for the socket, and then we need to connect, and we just pass a pointer here that represents the address that we're connecting to. And by the address that we're connecting to, I mean the host, the IP address, and the port number for IPv4 and IPv6. And there's this generic API, which is the same, looks the same regardless of whether you're using IPv4 or IPv6 or some future protocol when we decide 128 bits isn't enough. So you might say, okay, so where did this address info come from? Well, there's a get adder info function, and this is going to do the name to address conversion. So you call this function with names, it gives you addresses. Addresses are what the actual socket and connect call takes, but you want to work with names, so it does that translation. So here's an example of a call to that. So we get a host name and a port name, like cs.virginia.edu, and I just specify the port name as the number. And I pass that to get adder info along with this hints thing. And in the hints, I can give extra information about things I want about the socket I want to create. And it fills in this address info struct, and I just use that to actually do my connection. So all that socket and connect call actually use addresses, and this is what does the name to address translation for us. And pass a pointer to fill in. Now on the server side, we use the same call to set up our server, but rather than passing the information to connect, we're going to end up passing it to bind. So I'm going to do fill in an address info struct, but I'm going to pass that information to bind to say, hey, I don't want to connect to here. I just want to make this the address, the port number of my server, so people know how to contact me. And the call looks almost the same. You just have to specify in the hints, hey, this is for a server, so it knows to give you the right format of address. Okay. So questions on sort of how these APIs look? So you can see we have this nice separation between names and addresses as far as the APIs. The people who are implementing socket and connect don't have to care about how names work. They can use the addresses that are convenient to actually send and receive messages. Okay. So, right. I guess one thing I should mention, since we're dealing with the real internet, if you try this, you might say, okay, I can just run a web server on my machine by figuring out what the port for web servers is and using it. And if you try that, you'll probably find out, huh, it doesn't work if you're using a Linux-like system. On Unix, there's this convention that port number 0 through 1023, they're for root, for the system administrator. So if you actually wanted to do this, you need to use higher port numbers, which are okay for users, or get system run your program as root with system administrator permissions. Is this a good idea? That's hard to say. Okay. So questions on sort of how this socket setup worked? And you can see here, just as a reminder, we did this listen to make it a server socket, which means that when we actually want to talk to a particular client, we have to call accept to get one of those ones which is paired with one client. Okay. So the picture I showed you earlier had a problem, which I am surprised no one pointed out, which is that we're doing one connection we close the connection, then we start the next connection, which means we can only handle one client at a time. And sometimes that's fine, but often you might find that a lot disappointing. So there's an easy solution to that, where we're going to modify this pattern, where we're going to call accept, and the first thing we're going to do after we call accept is spawn a new process or thread and have it deal with the connection, and then we're going to call accept again in the original process or thread. This is probably the simplest way, not the only way, but the simplest way of handling multiple connections at once. Yeah?
After forking, which processes have access to the connection code? How do they handle if both
read? So the question is, if we fork, it seems like both processes should have access to the socket. Possibly, and the answer is they do, you were asking. They do, because we copy, just like when you called pipe and you called fork, they both had access. So one thing is, just like when we were creating pipes in our shell, we probably would want to close the extra copies in the child process that we don't plan on using there, and close the things we don't plan on using in the parent process there. That's one thing. As for what happens if they both happen to use the same one, well, for accept, whoever calls accept first gets the first connection. Whoever calls accept second gets the second connection. For read and write, the reads and writes happen one at a time, but they all will happen. The thing which happens with accept is actually useful. Some servers deliberately do this, where they'll just have multiple processes or threads calling accept at the same time. Other questions? So another thing about doing multiple things at once, you might notice here, is I'm assuming that the way our protocol works, that we've chosen to implement with this connection, is that my client sends something to my server sends something back, and that's all that happens. And for many things, that's fine. Like for an HTTP server, a web server, that's plenty. But there's some things we want to do where that model doesn't actually work very well. So one example is like a chat server, where we want the server to always be sending stuff to the client about messages it should display, and the client will randomly send something to the server when the client has something to send. And sockets support this, but the question is, what do you do that? So one solution is you have two threads or two processes per connection, one for reading, one for writing. Another solution is to do event loop type stuff we briefly mentioned earlier in the semester. So questions? This, yeah.
Is next assignment going to still remain FTP, or are we switching to
the... The next assignment is the one labeled two-phase, which I hope I updated everywhere. I'm sure I'll do that before the end of the fat read assignment. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So one thing about sockets is that I've shown you sockets that work over the internet. And it seems like, of course, that's what you want to do. That's what sockets are useful for. Why would I want it anywhere else? But POSIX defines a special kind of sockets that only work on the local machine. And you'd say, that doesn't seem very useful, but it turns out it is used a lot. So one example is on Linux, when you start an application and it opens up a window, the way that works is that it talks to a display managing program via one of these local sockets. Has to be some way to know, how do I contact the display managing program? And these sockets that work on the local machine use files. So the socket just has a file name. It's a file in a directory. You just specify the name of that file, and that's how you contact the display server. And for something like a display server, well, it makes sense that you wouldn't want it accessible to other machines, at least by default. So that's something you'll do. And yes, speaking of the assignment, so we're going to have an assignment where we're going to end up using these, but not with the POSIX API. We're going to use something, an RPC system, we'll talk about what that is later, that we'll use these for testing. So, and the reason we'll use these is that this will avoid all sorts of issues with what port number do I use. You're just going to use a file in your directory, and if you want to test this on a shared machine, it's easy to figure out how to avoid conflicts. Just don't use the same directory as anyone else. And but from the POSIX API point of view, the way these work is that we can use our normal connect call, but we create an address that just contains a path name. And as I said, these are used a lot. Like, this is a partial list of, like, actually, like, many pages of active Unix domain sockets on my laptop, like, yesterday. So we can see things like this one is the display server. This one here is the print server. So if a program wants to print, it just uses this mechanism to contact the thing which knows how to print. Some questions on these local only sockets? Okay, so talked about the connection abstraction, and that's really useful and really common. But we're going to talk about something which is higher level than that, and arguably more useful, or at least more featureful. This is an idea known as remote procedure calls. So the goal that we're going to have is I'm going to write a bunch of functions, and it's going to be possible for me to call them on another machine. Hence, I have procedure calls where I just call a function. We're going to have remote procedure calls where I call a function over on some other machine. And part of the goal here is that some library and tools are going to handle all the details for me. As far as I'm concerned, it just looks like I'm using functions. And I know how to use functions. Using functions is really convenient. I do it all the time in my code, hopefully. So this seems like it would be really useful if we could do it. And this goal is a common goal we'll see in distributed systems. We're going to have this goal of transparency. And by transparency, I mean we can see through the system being distributed. It looks the same as if it weren't. So that's our ideal, is that for our remote procedure calls, that if we implement this correctly, can we make it so it looks the same as a local call? And the answer is, well, kind of. We can do a pretty good job. So we're going to talk about how to do this. So what type of mechanism should we, what should the high-level approach be for how we would make this work? How are we going to make it so I can call things like their local functions and it actually does something, calls a function on another machine? So one part we need to deal with, another machine, is that we want them to look like a local function. So can someone give me the simplest cheating way of making something look like a local function?
Just
The, yeah.
Rename all of your functions.
Rename them? Okay, what do you mean by rename?
It's replace your original local function with a function with the same call syntax that just connects it off of it.
Yeah, so our trick is gonna be that we can just make a local function that with the same name and the same prototype, but that actually does the work. And this is, in fact, what we'll do. So a typical remote procedure call implementation will generate what we'll know as stubs. And these are wrapper functions that stand in place of the real functions. So rather than calling the actual remote procedure, we'll call this stub function. And the stub function will implement all the work. Now, we'll also have stubs on the other side of the remote procedure, which we'll call the server side, that we'll call you. Because what's the easiest way to make from the side of you're being called, to make it look like you're really being called locally? We'll have something call you locally. So that's exactly what we're going to do. The library is just going to make an actual local call based on the information it got over the network. At the server side and at the client side, we're going to take an actual call the client makes and turn it into some message we send over the network. So this is what this sort of looks like at a high level, is that we have this stub that we're going to call. It's going to do something with the RPC library, which is going to actually send stuff over the network to the other machine. And at the other machine, we're going to have another stub that, rather than being something that's called, it's something that knows how to call a function and to take back the return value from that call. So at both ends, it's going to look like a local procedure call because we actually start and finish with a local procedure call. It's just all this stuff in the middle. So one question is, well, where does this stub come from? And most commonly, we're going to have a tool that's part of our RPC system that's going to generate code. So it's going to take the specification of what are the procedure calls we want, and it's going to write code that implements the stub. And in this way, it can handle any prototype we care about. And part of the job of this is that this stub needs to know about what are the arguments to this function, and it needs to somehow convert that into bytes that can be sent over the network. And we're also going to have a stub at the server end, and that's going to know how to undo that conversion to bytes we can send over the network to actually make the local procedure call. And also, we have to do the conversion in the reverse direction, because we have a return value at the server end. We need to convert the return value to bytes. And at the client end, we need to convert the bytes back to the return value. Another piece we're going to need is that somehow we need to identify what the function being called is over the network. So we're going to have some way of choosing the identifier for what that function is send over the network. So we need that. And we also need some way of specifying what server am I talking to. So this is the first way in which probably we haven't quite gotten this to be completely transparent. So the way this is going to end up looking is, let's say I have my remote procedure call as makedir. Well, I need to specify what server am I doing it on. So a common way this might happen is we'll get something, some context. I'll show you like a more real example of that, where we'll specify the server name once, and then we'll pass that to the code which is generated. Or alternately, we'll do, and this is what we'll end up doing in the assignment, we'll have some object-oriented sort of way where we'll get an object that represents the remote server, and we'll actually make local method calls and not just procedure calls. But we need some way of specifying the server to run with. And we'll pick up on sort of the other details we're missing next time.